Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 400 CTOs who share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insights into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, please visit alphalist.com to find out more on how to apply. Thanks a lot to our sponsor, the About You Cloud. The About You Cloud offers a full-stack e-commerce solution as a service that runs on exactly the same infrastructure as the About You Shop does. It is mobile-first, can act as headless system, event-driven, can be fully localized, and is super integrated into existing solutions. Besides that, it is designed and developed by a really smart CTO and friend of mine, Sebastian Betz. About You has set up a task force for retailers and brands that want to be quick in the COVID situation. This task force will help you with the launch of your shop, as well as with fulfillment, marketing, support, and internationalization. Simply write to hello@aboutyou.com to be supported by this task force. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby, and I recently thought, well, I need to get some more guests from Germany and Europe. Luckily, I stumbled into Frank, the CEO of Nextcloud, and I'm pretty excited about what Nextcloud does. I didn't know that much about it. So Frank, maybe you can introduce yourself first.
Sure. Yeah, first of all, thanks a lot for having me. Now we have an awesome podcast with two German speaking broken English, but yeah, sure, it will be fun. Yeah, so yeah, you already introduced me as the CEO and founder of Nextcloud. Of course, I did all kinds of things before. So I actually got in open source. I'm sure we'll talk about open source a bit during this podcast. I got into open source like over 20 years ago, where I contributed to different projects like the KDE desktop or other projects too. I also founded a few initiatives myself. And in a professional life, I also like worked on a lot of different startups and also founded a few of them before. Also partly in the US. So I had a company in the US with US investors, venture capital involved. But as I mentioned, now I'm doing Nextcloud and I moved back to Germany. And this is like a boring German company without any fancy investors. It's very optimized for sustainability, which means we are, it's very important for us to be profitable, and we are profitable, and we grow organically. And yeah, that's what I'm doing at the moment.
Okay. Focusing on sustainability, I'm happy to hear more later on. But maybe digging a bit deeper in your nerd path and the KDE history. So that is really like a very, very nerdy thing and a very nerdy fact. What did you do there? Did you actively develop a desktop environment or?
I did all kinds of things. I mean, at the beginning, I was just a user. So I ran like in the middle of the 90s. I ran like SUSE Linux, which came with a KDE desktop, and a friend of me of mine showed
very
it to
German,
me.
Yeah.
this is so German, so German. I can even be more German. I can tell you the reason for that, because the SUSE was very popular in the 90s, including with me, because it had drivers for ISDN cards built in. So this was the nerdy way to go online, but mainly only existed in Germany. So yeah, very nerdy in German. But I saw that for the first time and I was like, wow, this is so amazing. This is just a super usable Linux desktop, which looks as good as Windows 95, which was the reference at the time. But what really blew me away was that I then learned that this was not done by a company, but this was as an open source project done by just thousands of volunteers from all over the world, working together, contributing to this code, and basically together, this community, this open source community, built this awesome desktop with these nice applications. And there is no business model, there is no very few personal meetings, no product management, no other management, just as a very organic community process. And yeah, this really impressed me a lot. And then at KDE, I did all kinds of things. I mean, of course, a bit of development, but also a little bit of artwork. I worked on some web applications. I built KDE Look and KDE Apps and GNOME Look and a bunch of other websites where basically the community can collaborate on artwork and applications. In a way, it was the first app store way before before Apple and Microsoft. And then later also did event management and was a board member of the KDE EV for a while, where I was vice president responsible for managing donations and money
sounds very official. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really weird because we have this fancy title, but I mean, you basically don't manage anything because they're just thousands of volunteers. But the main job was managing incoming donations, organizing conferences, this kind of things. It was not really like a management position in the same way you are managing a company.
And now recapitulating on that, I recently, I think yesterday when we talked first, visited the KDE website again. Honestly, I didn't visit it for ages. It also, I share a bit of history there because I was a KDE user myself and actively installed every alpha version on my working computer, not being able to work for days because of that, because of downloading all the packages and compiling stuff. And then like half of it didn't work and I had no clue of C++ and so on. So it wasn't my most productive time.
I was even crazier. So I had a script on my computer, which every night downloaded or did the latest CVS or subversion at a time checkout and compiled everything overnight. And then every morning when I looked into my computer, I had like the latest master branch. And of course, stuff broke all the time. So, and I was like days where, okay, I guess I'm not reading emails today because my email client doesn't work. So, but it was a very enthusiastic time. We all were waiting for the big breakthrough for the year of the Linux desktop.
Yeah, it still takes a while, right? Linux on the desktop is already there, right? I mean, if you count in mobile, it is there. So, I think.
Yes.
That is a true success story. But coming back to the question I wanted to ask, so I think KDE is pretty much not existing anymore, right? No.
The community is still this community is still there. The product is still there. It's still alive. I personally think it missed a little bit the opportunity to become like really big and successful. There were some strategic mistakes, in my opinion, but no, it's still alive and kicking in the niche, of course.
I think open source can just work if someone jumps in as a dedicated person and builds a company out of that. Otherwise, I think it's really hard to maintain something like a desktop as a hobby or something like a cloud software as a hobby. I think that just doesn't add up, right? And I think that is what also changed in the last years from KDE being a very open community driven project. As a template, we see that this just doesn't add up, right? It's just companies that grow out of open source projects can be successful whenever they really are managed properly, right? And then whenever someone really makes a living out of it, that's my, yeah, my understanding of how the world works. Would you say this is true, or?
You're asking the big philosophical questions here. It's good. So yeah, I mean, for a long time, for like, I don't know, 15 years, I tried to improve the world, change the world with a pure open source project like KDE and others, without a business model, without paid people and so on. And yeah, it's true. Nowadays, I'm trying the same with a combination of a company and an open source community. And I think both models has its pros and cons, but I sort of agree with you that the standard self-organized community projects, they are lacking some things that companies are better with. I mean, for example, just basic marketing, because in KDE, I don't know, like 95% of the volunteers or 99%, I don't know, are developers writing software. But you don't really have a lot of marketing volunteers who are really professional, good marketing people. But that's, of course, needed to make your product popular. And then even worse, in other areas, maybe you want to work together with companies. Or maybe you want to convince, I don't know, maybe you want to convince Dell to ship KDE together with the Linux distribution on some of their laptops, right? You need to have a serious business meeting to do this kind of partnership. And that's something that the community is really, really struggling with. And other things, product management, right? In a way, the volunteer community, this is just creative chaos. Like everybody does what they want. And at the end, there is a good product, but I'm sometimes irritated about the priorities because, I don't know, some developers just have fun with refactoring some backend component, which doesn't change anything because they're motivated by fun, but they like to do that. And then there are some obvious things where every end user is complaining that somebody's not working or missing, but no one is interested in fixing that. So sometimes it's some product management is a good thing. And that, sorry for talking too long, but maybe even more important than product management is also to have like customers. Because so we have this organization here where I have to pay everybody here in the company every month, which means I want customers, and customers only come to us if we have a good product. So everybody here at Nextcloud is very intensivized to make our users and customers happy. This is something open source communities sometimes don't have. They just like do something for fun, and if it works for me, that's fine. If half the world complains that the email client is bad, then who cares?
Yeah, and so that means that every open source project that wants to go big needs a CEO, essentially, right?
I'm not really saying that. I think there are pros and cons for both models. And there are some examples of like pure open source projects where you don't have a single vendor company behind it. I mean, the Linux kernel itself, right? Linux kernel is just lots of companies and volunteers like contribute together and to make the Linux kernel great. But there is not a single company who owns it. There is no the Linux kernel doesn't have a product manager, right? There's also no business model behind the Linux kernel. So it's not really a company thing. So this can also work very well.
But I guess in terms of the Linux kernel, there are also very few people that are contributing at least 80% of it, right? I would assume, at least. I didn't check it, but typically for all of the bigger open source projects, or not only open source projects, but also company projects, you have like that very, very, very inner circle of people that are contributing code, right?
Yeah, sure. But I mean, this is always the case. I mean, this is doesn't matter if it's a product done by a company or by a collaboration of different companies or as an open source project. Of course, you always have the core people, and then you have the people who are more working in the outer areas of the product, maybe working on plugins or drivers or QA and packaging and things. And you really you don't see a lot of software where you have, like, I don't know, a few hundred core developers. I mean, yeah, it's always a smaller circle. Yeah.
And especially for the modern open source projects, you often have that one contributor that really drives the product, right? For example, I recently checked Drone.io. I don't know if you know it. It's a deployment tool, and like the founder of it was all over the place, or also other projects which came from the open source world. They typically don't have that many contributions from other developers, but mostly the one who drives it.
That's, by the way, a drawback of having an open source project basically controlled or dominated by a company. Of course, it's a bit more complicated, depends on the business model and the licensing and things, but one of the key things to have a big, happy community is that everybody should be on an equal playing field. And I mean, there should be have the same amount of control about the thing that's going on than everybody else, because who wants to be, I don't know, I don't want in my free time help a company being successful without being paid. That's weird. But if this is just a group of people and we are all like equal and we all benefit from everything, then I'm also helping myself because I use the software myself. Then why not? And this has something to do with then with the license. I mean, we at Nextcloud, we use the HGPL license, and we don't do any open core or dual licensing or other things. So basically, really everybody is using the same software. It's really like paying customers and community people and developers. Everybody's using the same software, so we're all equal. And that's something that with the latest licensing discussion around Elastic and others, the company is grabbing a lot of control over the code, which is a good way to kill your community. And that's not good.
But if you look at the contributors at Elastic, you will see that the CEO, Shay Bannon, did like 80% of the commits at least. So
well, okay.
Maybe the
community was already dead before, so there's nothing to kill.
Sure. Maybe. going back to that, how does it work then to have a direction as an open source project, as a larger open source organization as yours? If everyone is equal, like how can you then in a way outline a direction? How do you do product planning? How do you do future roadmap planning? How does it work?
Another big question. At the end, it's this balance between having an open process where everybody can do what they want. But at the end of the day, we as a company, we also need to have a working product, like always, because that's what our customers are paying us for. So you need to balance both things. There's so many things that are important for that. The first is that the community and the company should have to share the same vision, the same goals. And of course, we have some, with Nextcloud, we have some clearly defined goals because we want to enable people to host it themselves. We want to protect their data. We respect privacy, security, usability. So in overall, our community really wants to have the same thing than our customers. And also, the Nextcloud should work from very small installations to very big ones. So it's very important for us that Nextcloud works on a Raspberry Pi for 2 users, but also for a big cluster for 2 million users with the same code. That's very important. So if you have the same goals, then your community and your employees most likely walk in the same direction. But then another thing is that,
those goals came from yourself, or how did you initially come up with your values and your goals?
Yeah, now in the case of Nextcloud, they came from me because I did the former project called OwnCloud. This was something that I started. I also wrote 100% of the code of OwnCloud 1.0, which I'm very happy that none of the code survived. It's really good. But I mean, I started it, yes. So the original ideas, this was communicated by me even in the initial announcement. This is about self-hosting, about privacy, security. And this was the goals, yeah. I think it's important to have this kind of goals. If you do, I don't know, some soul searching later on and trying to find your goals, then I don't know, then probably something is wrong. Because what did you do before finding your goals? I mean, you have to have goals.
Okay, and that is attractive for people, or was attractive for people that then joined as developers and contributed to your goals as well. And did you pay them or?
No. So at the beginning, it was just, I was invited to speak it was actually a KDE conference at the time in San Diego, where I was invited to give a keynote. And then I was like, oh gosh, I guess I have to speak about something interesting. And I'm the type of person who always have lots of ideas. So I have on my desktop here, I have a text file. I still have it with lots of ideas in it. So I have ideas for startups for 20 lifetimes. So no problem. Went through the list and I thought, okay, I have this keynote that I give and this is in 3 months. So I guess I have to talk about something interesting. Why don't I implement some of my ideas? And this was then OwnCloud, the first version at the time. And then I announced it at a conference and then immediately press wrote about it. And then I put it in a public repository and created a mailing list. And then, the first contributions really came in a few days later. And then it was one person, three people, 5 people, 10 people. Then I invited everybody to my office at the time to just meet for a weekend and work on the code together. Yeah, then we had a meeting of 5 people. It was lots of fun and did a lot of things. And then the next meeting, we had 10 people, 20 people, 50 people, 100 people showed up. So it became bigger and bigger. And this was all unpaid. Only later, the idea happened that there can be a company around it, a startup.
And then that's an interesting path from being a small open source project to being part of the Bundescloud, as far as I've read, right? The German government is using your cloud solution with I don't know, 300,000 users or something. How did that add up?
I mean, this happened over, 6-7 years, right? It didn't really happen immediately. So this was a path to that. But it's true that if you always work on the next step, and I'm just the type of person who always works on the next step, next step, you sometimes, it's always helpful sometimes to take a step back and look at the big picture and thought, okay, there are several big governments and big organizations all over the world using this weird software that this group of friends basically built together. And that's sometimes mind-blowing. Yeah.
Can you imagine?
This episode is kindly supported by Fastly, the biggest challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is known as one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, the New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist.
And what is then, if you zoom out look 5 years in the future, what is happening then? What is the big master plan?
such a big master plan. I mean, it's not so different. I mean, the thing is that I grew up. I'm not that young, right? I'm like mid 40. So I basically experienced the growth of the internet in the 90s, and it was all like a big happy family, very decentralized websites, emails, FTP, all kind of decentralized services. And nowadays, the world is really moving into very centralized services. Like Amazon is hosting half of the internet. Half the internet is using Gmail by Google. Google is the default search engine. Social network is Facebook. The business world is dominated by Microsoft. So all these services are super centralized. Basically, a handful of companies are controlling all data, all communication, all applications of half of the planet. And that's something I'm not a big fan of. So my goals for forever was to trying to decentralize the internet again. And this is something we want to achieve with Nextcloud. So we already have like millions of users all over the world, like I said, from small Raspberry Pis, or use it in their company or university or government job or go to a service provider. Yeah, and my goal is to do more of that. So hopefully we have, instead of one gigantic cloud service, we have like, I don't know, 10,000 small ones all running Nextcloud or other software with similar goals of as Nextcloud. This would be my goal.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds like a good plan, at least, to reintroduce the freedom of choice, right?
Yes, exactly.
And how big is your company?
So we are like 55 people at the moment, I think, because we're actually growing quite fast. Lately hired like 11 more people, and I have we talked about it earlier. I have like lots of job interviews because we have lots of open positions. So 55 people. Last year was again very good for us. So we doubled in order intake again last year. The year before we also doubled. So the horrible situation with COVID-19 is in a very weird way good for us, because our software can be used for remote work and home office and remote schooling and this kind of use cases. So it's a good thing for us from a business perspective. Of course, it comes with the usual challenges. We're also suffering a bit as a team that we never can have a meet in person, and a lot of things are not good. But yeah, the need for our software is growing.
And I think there are other effects such as GDPR, Privacy Shield, and so on that actually make your stuff grow, right?
Yes, this is very interesting. Actually, just before this interview, we had like an internal call where we discussed something in this area, because like Privacy Shield was killed last summer, which means it's storing your data in the US is no longer GDPR compliant. Of course, this was a ruling of the highest court in Europe, which is a very abstract thing. And I think the position of most companies and organizations was the last few months something like, interesting, but let's see how it goes. But it seems that a few days or weeks ago, a university in Sweden actually basically was the first victim. So they stored some of the internal private user data at box.com, which is a US cloud provider. And now they got a 50,000 euro fee for doing that. That's interesting, because now this will happen more and more, because it's illegal to store your user data or customer data at US cloud services at the moment. It's just not GDPR compliant, which is the law in Europe. And organizations will have to pay like a lot of money for doing that in the future, which means there will be a strong demand of having something locally hosted or hosted in Europe. And then, yeah, the combination of Nextcloud together with a service provider who offers Nextcloud hosting, yeah, will become very, very attractive very soon.
So potentially it makes sense to found a Google alternative then in Europe and come up with a lot of services, right?
I mean, there are already companies in Europe who offer things. I mean, Google does a lot of things. I mean, email, for example, there are independent small email providers in Europe, and that's a good thing. Of course, they're suffering at the moment a little bit because they're just small and they don't have the scaling effect that the big ones have. And well, Google is also running like the biggest advertising network in the world, right? Which they can use then the email service to monetize it. And there's a combination which is hard. It's hard to compete. But I think this has the potential to change a lot of things. And I actually like it, not only because of Nextcloud, but because I think it will give a big boost to the software industry and to IT in general and to cloud services in Europe, which I think is a good thing to compete with China and the US.
Which is then, in a nutshell, similar to what the bigger regions or countries do with enforcing local solutions, right? It's just a bit more of a Trojan horse, I think, for that, because it's really like rolling up slowly and so on. But it's coming.
I think so. Of course, it's a big question, right? In general, I really would like to see the world like working more together and instead of less. So I'm not saying that. I don't know. Europe should be independent from everything. Obviously, the internet should be a force that's available to everybody from every place. But I think it's just the big problem if some areas have such a dominant position over others. And you see this in the old economy too, right? Where you have like developing countries where they really have a problem with catching up to the Western world or to China in all kinds of manufacturing and economic areas. But in IT, which is like my area, of course, the situation is just that, it's really dominated by US companies, which I don't have a problem with US companies. I just think there should be more alternatives, should be less centralization.
Which is partly hard because the US, for example, just is able, or in a lot of cases, is able to attract more developers. And more developers these days is a good thing to have, right? More talent.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
talent is key. Yeah. But it's like there's a lot of talent outside the US. We have people in Africa at the moment. There's a huge startup scene, lots of talented people. They often have a problem with like finding interesting local jobs because there's a chicken egg problem, right? Because they have the companies, they don't have the jobs, they don't have the economy, and then it's really hard to get out of this chicken egg problem. But with the internet, it has the chance to get people in underdeveloped areas, getting them involved in IT, maybe first as a community volunteer and then later getting a job out of it, which could help everybody.
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at Upwork, for example, I don't know if you use Upwork, but there are like many talents all over the world that I think otherwise would have no chance to earn that amount of money that they make out of Upwork, right? And they would just remain unseen. So I also think that this is a great thing. But coming back to your company, do you actually pay developers then to develop your stuff as well? I guess like part of your employees are developers, obviously, but how about contributors that do good stuff? Do you sponsor them on GitHub or?
We have there are two different kinds. I mean, employees are just paid as normal employees, right? And we are not paying like lower or smaller salaries because we're open source or something. That's not the case. We just have, you pay like standard salaries because, yeah, that's how it should be. And then we have the volunteers, and we don't really pay them in money. Of course, we help them in other ways. For example, we help them with traveling. I mean, traveling doesn't really exist at the moment, but a year ago when we still did our big conference in Berlin, then we just paid for the travel for contributors for all over the world to fly, to come to Berlin and meet in person. And we pay them for food and hotel and all kinds of things. And also if they're, I don't know, if they need something, we can help them, of course. But we don't really, I mean, we either pay them like normal salaries, then they're employees, or they're contributors, and then we don't pay them in money. We don't, there is no status where you like somehow are half paid or something. I think this is not a good thing.
But you, every once in a while, then spot a volunteer that has a lot of potential and ask him to become your employee, or?
Yeah. That's something we do all the time. It's actually relatively easy for us to hire people because we have this very big active community. And every time I need someone new, like I said, at the moment we are hiring, just looking for, I don't know, 10 more people in the development area. I can really go to core community contributors and ask, hey, what do you do for fun? How do you want to be paid to do the same? So that's quite easy for us. And also another thing is that this community is like all over the world, right? It's like totally distributed all over the world. And as an open source project, it's like obviously built in a way that this works. You can work from different time zones, different languages, different cultural backgrounds. It doesn't really matter. Everybody can be part of it. And because of that, our company is also built like that. So we can actually hire people all over the world. A lot of old economy companies still require that new employees are in the same city or something, which then is hard. But we have people all over the world, and that's, yeah, looks good for us.
And how do you synchronize? I mean, is there a moment of synchronization, or is it all asynchronously?
I think it depends on the job. If you're in development, then we use GitHub for the software development, and there we have like 100% asynchronous processes. The whole thing that how we work, which is very common, I think, with pull requests and code reviews and stuff like that, tickets, is it's completely asynchronous. It doesn't really matter in what time zone.
So no send-ups or nothing scrum,
no,
scrummy?
No. At least not textbook scrum. No, we have some things where I think some ideas are good. For example, we do time-based releases, release often, release early, and some other things where we follow scrum ideas. But yeah, other ideas like all these meetings, all these stand-ups, we don't really do that. No, I mean, there we have calls. I mean, sometimes when we do feature planning or, I don't know, UI review sessions or something where we have like real calls, and then everybody's invited, the whole community is invited to participate. And but that's not mandatory, right? If you're really in a completely different time zone, I mean, we have people in Hawaii, right? That's like the other side of the planet. So it's hard to participate in calls. This is voluntarily. But what I said earlier, this is development. This is easy. Because we have other things like sales or marketing where you really, really want to be in the same time zone than the customer or the journalist. And there, it's a bit more complicated. In these areas, we have a lot of, the most people are in Europe at the moment.
Okay.
Because this is also where we do most of our sales.
And you also have an office and so on.
We have two offices. We have an office in Stuttgart and one in Berlin, but both are quite small. I think we have 6 or 7 people in each office. and everybody else is from home. So we have a lot of marketing and also a lot of salespeople working from home. That's fine. That's we have the process for that. But the time zone is like more critical there. I mean, yeah. Customers want to have phone calls, and you should be able to do that.
Maybe one step back to developers, or let's say a distributed organization. One thing I think can be challenging is actually salaries, right? I mean, is someone working in the Ukraine, should he earn a Ukraine salary or should he earn a German salary? Do you have a strategy for that, or like a concept?
Another big question. Yeah, very good question. I don't have a full concept for that. No, it's of course one of the challenges. Yeah. So salaries are not the same. It's just not. I mean, you have people working from the US and have completely different salary structure than another employee from us is in Africa, as I said. That's really different. In general, we try to, in all cases, pay them like average or above average. It depends on a lot of factors. I don't have a good strategy to for that, because it also has something to do with like also how, because as I said, we don't have any big fancy investors, so we also rely on how it goes on the business side. Then we have more flexibility with salaries, but yeah, no, I don't have a very good fleshed out strategy for that.
So no data driven payments or anything where you you can look at the base salaries in the countries and look at how salaries go up and down and how you can do auto increase and stuff like that. I recently like think about it a lot, and I'd like it to in a way have a structure where you're obviously measured on your performance and also paid on behalf of your performance, but your salary, for example, automatically increases every year so that you don't have to negotiate. And I mean, inflation is always there, right? So why should you always have that moment of that awkward moment of shame when you discuss salaries? And if you were acting in a good way, that is in a way a bit strange, right?
That's an interesting idea that you somehow look at average salaries in the different regions and automatically adjust to that somehow if it goes up or down. Yeah, that's interesting. It's very computer scientist and answer to that, right? even better would be to build a neural network. To
it is, yeah. And the biggest problem is that if everyone does it, it won't work out anymore, right?
yeah,
it's like automatic trading. It also just works out as long as there are people that are manually trading.
True.
To copy.
Yeah.
So let's go one step further towards open source. So would you? I mean, open source became pretty much the playground of the big boys, from my perspective. So a lot of Google, a lot of Amazon, a lot of big corporates that come up with open source projects, that sponsor open source projects. Is it still possible if I decide now I want to do something on my own as an open source project and I want to make a living out of it? Do you think it's way harder than 5 years ago or 10 years ago when you started? Or
I think making a living with an open source based product is easier now than a few years ago because it's better understood, like by everybody, by the founders, by the developers, marketing, investors, customers. So this is easier. The real challenge is, of course, still to find an interesting niche where there's the need for a product like that, because you can't do everything with open source, right? The open source is just suitable for some t- types of products. If you want to build the next TikTok or I don't know, then there's no place for open source because it's a centralized service by nature. But if you want to do something in the middleware, some system in the infrastructure stack somewhere, then it has to be open source. Right? There's no lot of few proprietary pieces in the cloud stack nowadays. So this depends a bit how to find a good spot. But overall, I think open source is better understood, which is a good thing. I still remember like 15 or 20 years ago where a lot of companies were just afraid of the GPL. That stuff, oh, there's this viral, this viral license. And once we use a software that is GPL licensed, then it somehow like jumps to the next system and next system. And then a little bit later, everything is like open source. And then another few days later, you have communism in your company or something. I don't know. And there were all kinds of weird ideas. And I think this is over, right? I mean, everybody's using GPL software, open source software in the organization now. And people understand that's a good thing. It's not at all a problem.
Okay. Then I want you to give us three tips for being successful in open source. So if I start now, what would be your three life-changing tips then?
Life-changing tips. Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the big benefits of open source is that you can have a community, a contributor community. And I mean, really contributor. A lot of companies think that users are also communities. I really think contributors are really communities. I would really think hard if this is possible to build up. I think this is one of the key factors. I mean, if you look at like the big successful open source companies, I mean, SUSE, Red Hat, even Elastic until recently, or Mongo and all the others, they all benefit from their big community around it. And without a community, there would be nothing, right? I mean, nowadays, they have a lot of money and they can do their own marketing. At the beginning, they had no resources. And only because of the community, they became successful. So if I would found something new, I would really think how to build up this community as part of it. And then as a result of that, I would think about a license a lot, because a lot of people think that licenses are just boring, something for lawyers and I don't know. But at the end, the license is just basically the guidelines who can do what with your software. And that's something you really should think about very hard. It's the balance of power basically inside your community. And if you balance this well, it can be awesome for everybody. And if it's not balanced, then it can be bad for both sides. So I would really look into that, how to build a community and the licensing.
And is there a license finder or something where I can just hit a few buttons and then get the perfect license out? Or I mean, there has to be like a license database, right? Do I want others to charge money for my service or not? And stuff like that. Like a decision
exactly,
tree.
I don't know. It probably exists, but it's not so easy because this all is like, it all has something to do with the type of software you do, right? If you have a user facing application like Nextcloud, it's really different than if you're middleware, or really different if it's something that is like, that you offer cloud hosting, or it's about self hosting, or there are so many different things. And if you're B2B or B2C, and so many different things to consider, and the license is a result of that, in my opinion. So it's unfortunately complicated and really part of the good business plan.
Okay, understood. So those were two tips. So I'm still missing one.
another thing. Something that I see a lot in German startups, or like companies and startups I know, which always irritates me a bit, is that it seems that like 90% of the conversations I hear is about, hey, how to find the next awesome investor and how to do the next financing round and how to do, it's really about talking a lot about investors and investment. which I always find a bit weird, because I think the main focus of founders should be to build a working business model, and not just on paper, everybody can do that, but really test it in the market, like work with real customers, charge them real money, and then see how it scales and how you can be able to pay your team with the money you can charge the customers, because they want to have your product and they really want to buy it. This is like the key of everything. And once you have figured this out, like something that works and that's tested, and you have some customers who actually come to you and say, yes, what you're doing is so good that I'm paying money for that, then you can use investment to accelerate that and to make it bigger and scale it big. But don't make the mistake to think that the money comes from the investors. The money comes from the customers. The investors are just like a turbo that you can, an accelerator that you can use to grow faster than organically. But the money doesn't come from the bank or the investors. That's something that's not good.
A lot of founders think about selling straight away as well, right? Would you ever sell Nextcloud?
Yeah. Even worse, yeah. So no. This is like, there was the opportunity at some point to, I don't know, sell it to someone big and have a nice job in middle management of an IT company in the US, and that's just not my goal. I mean, if this would have been the goal, I would have done this for a long time already. But the goal is, as I said in the beginning, I really want to have built something that helps to decentralize the internet, that provides security and privacy to users. And also personally, I want to have a job that's fun. I want to work together with my friends, nice colleagues, and learn and build something great together. So that's my goal. I'm a good startup guy somehow, because I really like the work. For me, the goal is not to sell it as fast as possible, because I really like the work, you know. And I find it a bit weird when people already start to think about a big exit before you have even built up something.
Yeah. You know that I'm good with big questions, so I still have a little surprising closing question for you, Frank. So one of your contributors actually told me about a little Easter egg that he built into the latest Nextcloud app. And I now open it up on my iPhone. You see, this is the time machine feature. And I just have to hit this button here. And now we're moving back in time. To go to exactly the time 10 years ago when you initially founded OwnCloud and were VC backed and so on, and you were like writing your first services. We can observe you now for a while, and now we get the chance to whisper just one sentence into your ears. What would it be?
Okay, so basically, what would I say to my past self?
Right.
I would say be careful with what team you found a company. I would say make sure you're reading all the contracts. Sounds obvious, right? But yeah. You know how it is. Really think about all consequences of all decisions.
Be careful.
be careful, exactly. Be careful, because there are a lot of things in life where you can later change your strategy and your opinion. But when founding a company, not so much.
Okay, understood. So Frank, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for your time. And I now like really want to just buy a Raspberry Pi and install Nextcloud on it, or potentially introduce it in my company. So let's see. I have to check it out. And yeah, thanks a lot for your time, and hope to talk again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Fastly and the About You Cloud. If you want to know more about Fastly services, simply visit fastly.com/alphalist. If you want to get in touch with About You and hear more about the About You Cloud, simply write to hello@aboutyou.com. Thanks a lot.